Our guests today on the show are from Personal Choice Financial Advisors. You can get more information about them at financialrounds.com. But here with me today, we have Chris Hansen, the founder, as well as Robert Hansen and Ben Dobler. Welcome to the White Coat Investor Podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Jim.
Yeah, we wanted to introduce you to the audience as well as have you help answer some of their questions. But before we get into the questions, can you explain to us why you decided to become a financial advisor?
Back in 1991, I worked for Procter & Gamble. So I'm somewhat the same as a lot of people, I think, that follow some of your writings and so forth. I'm a career changer. I was a chemical engineer at Procter & Gamble, really got interested in personal finance. So after a while, people started bringing me proposals from their brokers for retirement and so forth. Well, back in the early 90s, as you know, everything was pretty much commissions. So I would explain to them the commission structure, what they were paying for the advice, and offer to show them, look, there's a lot better mutual funds out there. All the Vanguard funds were available and so forth. There are a lot better options out there at a lot lower cost. I can show you how to do this. What we found is almost all of them to the person came back and said, I do not want to do this on my own. I'm either going to pay you to do it or I'm going to hire somebody else to do it. So I went and actually got registered with the SEC, started the company in 1991, and started a fee-only financial planning practice when it was very, very uncommon to do that. Fast forward to 2016, my eldest son graduated from the University of Cincinnati Medical School. He's a neurologist at this point in time. And that's when I realized, as I helped him through a lot of the things he had going on, how much different it was working with doctors, with young doctors, with student loans, all the people chasing them, trying to sell them different things, getting all their finances up and running. I realized I really needed to become an expert in all these things. And we started to, as I got more and more expertise in it, we started to reach out. A lot of his friends reached out to us, and we started helping more and more doctors. And at this point, probably 90% of our new clients are physicians.
What do you think makes your practice or firm particularly unique? What are you really good at?
I'm Ben. So one of the things that I think we really specialize in doing is we work as a team. It's really hard as a financial planner or as anyone to know everything there is to know. So we each try and bring something different to the table. We're all CFPs. We all come from that background, but we each kind of have some special thing that we focus on. And so when people work with us, we meet with everyone. Depending on the time of year, it's going to be a different person, just depending on what's going on and who the best person is to jump in. So we really take a lot of pride in that, and that's something that we focus on.
Awesome. And what's your particular pricing model, and why did you choose that?
So we actually have a flat fee structure and an AUM structure. We have both options available, and we set it up that way, honestly, to help as many people as we possibly can. However they feel most comfortable to engage and however they like to set it up, we can help them set it up that way. And if you're leaning towards flat fee, that actually starts at $5,000 a year and goes all the way up to $15,000 a year, just depending on complexity. But we do, again, leaning towards trying to help as many people as possible, we do have a $3,000 a year engagement for residents and fellows.
All right. Thank you for sharing that. Let's get into some listener questions. This first one comes from John Michael, and let's take a listen.
Hey, Dr. Dolly. This is JM from West Virginia. I'm in my last year of residency, and I have a question about prioritizing a 403B versus a 457B. I'm very fortunate in that my spouse started her attending job this year, so I'm able to max both of my retirement accounts for the first time ever as a resident. The problem is that next year I graduate in June, so I won't have enough total salary to max out both my 403B and my 457 before I graduate. I'm still looking for jobs, so I don't know what retirement accounts I'll have access to at my future employer. My initial thought is that I should fully fund my 457B since it's less likely that I'll have one available as an attending. I feel there's a much higher chance that I'll have a 401k or a 403b that I can max out later in the year as an attending. Anyway, my question is really, am I thinking about this correctly? Am I missing anything? I appreciate all you do, and thank you for your guidance.
All right, great question, John. Who wants to take a stab at giving John something useful to think about this 403b versus 457b question?
I'll take a stab at this one. So this is a great question. I love this question. I do think he's thinking about it right. But I want to kind of dive a little bit into why and some of the things to watch out for. I think there's really three pieces, right? So the first piece is, what kind of 457B are we talking about? Is this a governmental 457B or is this a non-governmental 457B? So if this is a governmental 457B, this would mean it's a state hospital, university hospital, maybe it's a county hospital. And any of these scenarios would mean that this works kind of like a 401k that you might be used to. So it would mean after he leaves, he can roll this over into a new plan. He could roll it into an IRA, although depending on backdoor Roth and things like that, may not want to. But on the other hand, if this is just for a, say, a religious hospital residency, this is maybe a 457B that is non-governmental. And if that's the case, then this is really going to be forced out. He'll have to liquidate that plan over some short period of time after he finishes residency. So in that case, I would really steer him away from this. I do think most likely this is a governmental 457B because typically the non-governmental ones would only be available if you are a very high earner, a highly compensated employee. And of course, as we know about residency, that is very hard to get. So most likely is a governmental. The next piece, which kind of gets into the meat of the question here, is the contribution limit. So what makes 457B special, they don't count in the same bucket in the IRS's eyes as a 401k or a 403b. So for this year in 2022, as of this recording, you could put $20,500 into a 401k or a 403b or some combination thereof, and then go and put another $20,500 into that 457. He doesn't want to do that, of course, but the worry is that if he puts money into the 401k or 403b side, once he gets into his new job, he's going to come up short where he's only got maybe $10,000, $12,000 left in that bucket. If he starts with the 457B, he could put $20,500 in, turn around, start his attending position, and put that $20,500 back in there again. So that's just the nuance there. And then one additional quick note, it's pretty rare on the 457B side to have an employer matching contribution, but that does happen. When that happens, there is a unique feature there where on the 401k side or 403b side, you could put in the $20,500 and the employer match does not count against you. On the 457B side, if you're lucky to have a match on that side, that does count towards that $20,500. So just something else to watch out for. So be aware of those limits. I think he's looking at it right, that 457Bs are a little less common. Typically, you're going to have a 401k or 403B. So if it's that governmental variety, it probably is going to make a lot of sense to put money into that first and then leave the door open for the 401k or 403B bucket later on in his attending position.
What are the odds that he can actually access the new 401k or 403b in his first 6 months of the job? A lot of times you got to wait a while till the next calendar year or even a full year from the start of employment before you can make a contribution. What percentage of the time do you think the new employer actually lets you use that 401k as soon as you get there?
It's a great question, and it's going to come down to the plan. It's going to also come down to what type of employer matching contributions they offer. I wish I had a good rule of thumb here. It really does just depend. But if they are less generous with their matches, generally they're going to let you participate more quickly and easily and start putting money in on your own because it doesn't obligate them as the employer to do anything on top of that. So it is something to be aware of as you're contemplating those two. That is another possibility. And who knows, maybe this will be a 1099 role where he could open a solo. So any additional clarity that he would have in terms of specifically what kind of job he's getting, when they might be eligible for the 401k or 403b, that would obviously help.
Yeah, it's tough without having all the details in any situation. That's the benefit of sitting down with a financial planner like you guys, is you can bring in everything. You can look at all the details and make a comprehensive answer to any questions you have, rather than just having what people can record in a minute and a half on the speak pipe, in which you're left guessing about lots of details. All right, our next question comes from Evan. He's got a question about independent contractors. Let's take a listen to this one.
Hey, Dr. Dolly, longtime fan of White Coat Investor. Started following back in med school. Anyway, so I'm finishing a residency and looking into making that transition into attending hood and looking at jobs. Heard you needed some speak pipe questions, so here I am. My multi-part question can probably be boiled down into a 1099 versus W-2, which you had a great blog post on, by the way. So the job basically is, sounds like almost like partnership from get-go. It's a very low guaranteed base salary, less than fifth percentile, and sounds like the majority of the compensation will be through profit sharing. So for the job, while the default is W-2, they're open to structuring it as a 1099. And honestly, I'm kind of leaning toward that 1099 setup instead. As a 1099, it sounds like I'll still be able to buy into the group insurance plans and all other things are being equal. And if I don't mind the extra work and complexity of setting that up, the LLC or the S-Corp, would a 1099 make more sense than a W-2? Is there something else I might be missing that I should be alert for? And I guess on a more generalizable level, if all things are equal, docs could choose to be paid on W-2 or 1099, which would make more sense numbers-wise. Is there kind of a break-even point, like one side where W-2 is better, the other side is 1099 is better? Thanks.
Well, Evan, you got a lot of questions in there in a minute and a half. Let's see how many of them we can get answered. Who wants to take a stab at the overall topic, which is when should you take compensation as a 1099, it sounds like?
I can jump in on this one. And again, another great question by Evan here, because there's a lot of positives and negatives to both being a W-2 employee or a 1099 independent contractor. I would say, I think in general, it comes down to two main things. It's the differences in compensation and the ability of the individual. If they're comfortable with those complexities with setting up and managing the 1099 side of it. So I would say just benefits of being a W-2 employee. A lot of times you'll have those subsidized benefits. You'll have that health insurance. You'll have disability life insurance that the company's helped subsidizing for you. Again, it depends on the quality of those benefits, those plans, but you also have retirement benefits. So a lot of times they'll have the 401k with a 401k match or 403b and possibly a 457b. They might even have in the 401k the ability to do a mega backdoor Roth as an option, which is fantastic. But it really comes down to, are those plans decent plans? Are the investments inside those decent investments? So there's a lot that comes into play here. Even looking at when you're a W-2 employee, that the company helps pay for half of the Social Security and Medicare taxes. So they're helping subsidize that. So again, a lot of benefits of being that W-2 employee, but there's also a lot of benefits of being 1099 and independent contractor. So that's where, again, having the ability to set up your own retirement plan. Maybe as a W-2, you don't have a great 401k option. The investments aren't great. But you can set up a solo 401k. You can get more money put away. You can select your own investments. Even like after the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, you no longer can deduct your expenses as a W-2 employee on your tax return, but you can as a 1099 independent contractor. So there's, again, positives and negatives to both. One thing you do want to look out for that a lot of physicians have unique to them is pursuing PSLF. Which you can't do as an independent contractor. You need to be a W-2 employee for that. So you want to make sure your student loans are being factored in. But you really just got to weigh the positives and negatives to both. Overall, how is the compensation different? Again, if the compensation is absolutely identical, you'd almost always lean towards the W-2 employee side. But if you're leaning towards 1099 and independent contractor, you just want to make sure they gross it up. You'd want to push for that higher compensation for that lack of benefits that you have.
Yeah, so especially having to pay both halves of the Social Security and Medicare taxes, maybe one of the greatest benefits of being an employee that a lot of people don't think about. They think, oh, 1099 or W-2. They don't think 1099 getting paid more versus W-2 being paid less.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, let's move on to the next question. This last one we'll do together. This one's got some questions about, that classic dilemma, Roth versus traditional.
Hey, Dr. Dolly. I had a two-part question about Roth versus traditional 401k contributions. I recently listened to a podcast of yours and got a little confused during a short segment of it when you mentioned if someone is like you in a relatively high bracket, you're actually putting more money on an after-tax basis if you're making the Roth contribution. So really what you should be comparing is putting $20,500 into a Roth account or putting something like $13,000 into a tax-protected account and investing another $7,000 or so into a taxable account. Could you explain what you meant here? And secondly, you also mentioned that for someone who's in the same tax bracket at contribution and withdrawal comes out ahead with the Roth. How is this possible if, for example, I was in the 35% marginal bracket, contributed to a Roth account, withdrew tax-free at retirement, versus saving 35% on taxes with the traditional contribution and paying that 35% at withdrawal? Thanks for all you do.
All right. You want to give your thoughts on this topic?
Okay. Yeah, I think a lot of this comes from if you simply take a look at in lower tax brackets, having, say, $27,000 to put away in your 401k, be it Roth or conventional. When you run that scenario of I'm putting $20,500 into the my 401k, whether I go Roth or I go conventional portion on that, and then I take, say, the $6,500 that's paid to taxes, either put it in my tax account or I put it in a taxable account. If you're in an identical, say a 22%, a 12 or a 22% tax bracket, you run that scenario out, they're almost identical other than the slight tax drag you're going to have on the money you put into the taxable account. So in that case, I think as you stated, the Roth IRA is going to have a bit of a benefit in that scenario. But again, what we tell doctors, it's any kind of rule of thumb like this usually doesn't fit very well. One of the places that doctors are very, very different, most of the people that we deal with who are not doctors, they have one plan to choose from. It's a 401k or it's a 403b. So part of that scenario with a doctor would be, I can put this into a conventional 401k. What do I do with my 6,500? Well, unlike most industries, I have a 457 option. I have a top hat option. I have some other pre-tax option I can go to. I also have enough of an income that I can do a backdoor Roth IRA. I may have a mega backdoor Roth IRA. But if I can completely remove the taxes from that equation, then that kind of gives the tax deferred option somewhat of a benefit. Because again, at 12 to 22%, where again, that rule of thumb kind of sits, if I look at that and say, but I'm a doctor, I might be in the 22, but I'm probably in a 32, 35, 37%. Everything I put into this plan comes off the top. It comes off at my 37% tax bracket. When I'm taking this money out, I've got a lot of room between 0 and 37% taxes. I'm going to get that advantage. Not everything's going to come out at that 37% taxes. The other piece that really comes into play that helps the pre-tax side is, especially most of our physicians are young physicians. They've got student loans. And if I can lower my income, I lower my student loan payment if I'm looking for forgiveness. So that's actually kind of an extra tax you want to include in there as you think about the equation. If I'm self-employed, the QBI deduction comes into play there. It's one of those that, again, it boils down to, and I think we said this for all three answers, it comes down to, it just depends on what else you've got available. You've got a lot of other options available. What's the best one in that particular situation?
Yeah, for sure. Great thoughts on the QBI or 199A deduction, as well as the student loans. Those factors absolutely come into play. And, you know, for at least as long as that deduction exists, and as long as the forgiveness program exists anyway. But a lot of people just see tax-free and they're like, oh, Roth must be better. They don't realize there can be pretty significant tax arbitrage of saving money while you're putting it in at 37% and then bringing it out and filling the 10% and 12% and 22% and 24% brackets with those withdrawals.
Absolutely.
And that's why for most docs during their peak earnings years, tax deferred is a great deal. And so keep that in mind. But I think the main point is you just got to be thinking in terms of after tax amounts, you know, when you're saving money. Because $20,500 in a tax deferred account is not the same as $20,500 in a tax-free account. So you've got to make some kind of an adjustment to compare those. Well, awesome. It's been great chatting with you. I appreciate you coming on and help answering our listeners' questions. For those who are interested in learning more about Personal Choice Financial Advisors, the best place to do that is to go to financialrounds.com. And they stand ready to help you with any financial planning questions you need, investment management concerns you have. You can check them out there on the website and sign up for an introductory phone call with them if you are so inclined. Appreciate your time, guys.
Thanks. We appreciate your time, Jim.
Thanks, Jim.